From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. Welcome to The Treatment. I'm sitting across from a man who you may know, of course, as Brad Pitt or one of the stars of Moody's Point.
Yeah.
And also, again, as I like to say, the closest I will ever get to Hamilton is my guest, Taron Killam, who's sitting across from me. He's made his debut as a writer-director with the film Killing Gunther, which I actually feel in some ways is very close to Illegitimacy. They're both kind of these comedies about abandonment issues.
Yes, yes, absolutely. No, you've latched on to my—
I boiled it down.
Yeah, yeah.
Where does this come from? Why are you making fun of people being left behind?
I know. I don't know, because my family is very tight, very close, mom and dad. We're together. They're now separated, but we're together all through my childhood. Yeah, I don't know. It's a great point. I think it's the world of spies and assassins is a lonely world. So I think maybe I, you know, worked in backwards towards that. Illegitimates to me, you know, because I grew up loving James Bond and watching all the old Connery and Moore.
So who's your favorite Bond?
Probably Sean. Not probably. Definitely Sean Connery.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. Connery, number one. Craig is very high for me, like very high up, just because it's like real danger. And it was something so new, so different, especially Casino Royale for me, where it was a reimagining, but it felt somehow more honest to everything we knew about the character at that point. But being a child of the 90s and Nintendo 64, Pierce Brosnan will—
The best James Bond game ever, GoldenEye.
In the world. And I have still working my Nintendo 64, and you can't connect it to— you have to get an old TV.
Because it's got the old jacks.
It's literally like rectangles and hexagons, like shooting triangles at each other. Like you can't even follow the game anymore because of the sort of pixel ratio that's there. But yeah, oh my gosh, hours and hours and hours of GoldenEye all through college. And
I think there's no geek point left to touch on now.
I mean, I'll go as deep as you want.
Sadly, so will I. Yeah. But what I wanted to talk to— there's so much to talk about. I mean, I actually introduced myself to you at Comic-Con at 2014, you were sitting with the host of Late Night, and
yes,
I just told you how much I liked you in 12 Years a Slave.
Thank you very much.
Which
yeah.
Steve had just shown it to me a few months before. I sat and watched that in a room by myself.
Yeah.
So you haven't lived until you've watched that room. You're white knuckling.
Sure.
And I walked out and the publicist was sobbing.
Yeah. I know. I saw it with maybe two other people. So, you know, like not many more in attendance at the first screening. And, you know, always a different experience watching something you participated in, because it's just that much harder to separate character from reality. And when Scoot and I arrived to shoot our scenes, they just finished filming Lupita's scene, her dramatic scene, the vicious, violent, like the worst part of the whole movie. And the crew, you know, it was in Louisiana in summer, and they were just drained. You could just tell, like it took everything out of everybody. And though Scoot and I's characters end up being deceitful and evil, a majority of our scenes are quite pleasant, actually, because it's all about seduction.
And it's the Pinocchio scene.
Exactly, where the fox and the cat. Yeah, so it was a really joyful experience. We were staying in New Orleans. Scoot, I don't know if you met him, is just the loveliest, greatest guy. We got along like gangbusters. We were there for 2 weeks. I love New Orleans. I think it is actually my favorite American city, just because I find it to be incredibly unique and specific. You can't compare it to anything else, you know.
It feels Chicago, European, doesn't it?
It really does.
See, I've never been to New Orleans, so I know.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we were talking about being foodies. It's music, art, food, and history. It's really just an extraordinary city. So I had the best time, and I flew from there to Boston to shoot The Heat, you know, with Melissa McCarthy, who's one of my all-time favorite comedians ever. I started going to Groundling shows just to see her perform. And it was like, you know, a very pleasant experience, but in some ways more laborious, you know what I mean, more technical, because there was like action stuff. So it's always so funny to me, one, that I'm in a period drama about slavery that won an Academy Award, but also that the experience in doing it was such a pleasant, wonderful, happy experience. Yeah, it was none of it makes sense.
Well, my guest, apparently the only person who smiled during the making of 12 Years a Slave is Taron Killam.
His
first film as writer, director, and star is Killing Gotham. Since you brought up The Heat, because it is an action comedy, but it also has a really interesting sort of crucial emotional point where everybody's trying to connect with somebody else. Everybody's trying to – it's about these desperately lonely people who are trying to kill the one person who means something to them.
Right. Yeah.
Where does this come from? It's
really
interesting.
The concept, just the conceit of a profession to kill people for money has always been, I think, as a kid, romanticized and was cool in action. And the second I start analyzing it, it's absurd. And just based on – the values instilled in me, like horrible, horrible and awful. And you must be a sociopath. And so the idea of these people who are so disconnected to their own humanity in some level.
And all of them trying to be something they're not. I mean,
exactly
Blake's
right.
trying to be very cool.
Playing at,
and so now it's trying to be this tough girl who has her own daddy issues.
Yes.
And it's that's what's really interesting. Everybody wants to be something that they are not.
They have their facade, right? They have their calling card, which is their identity, their look. You mentioned Luc Besson earlier walking in, and that's definitely an influence on me. I mean, the professional.
Sure.
And
Fifth Element.
Fifth Element, for sure, of this heightened design, this heightened character, this identity. Magnificent Seven's one of my all-time favorite films.
Oh, is it?
Dirty Dozen.
Sure.
Yeah, I love assembling the – I love – we need the experts. We need the team.
Is Ronan one of those films for you too?
It was very – I mean, even in The Look and The Gathering and The Warehouse.
Because I thought of Ronan as I was watching the film.
Yes. Oh, cool. Good. Yes. Yeah, 100%. If we'd gotten Jean Reno in this film, I literally would retire.
You did almost as well. You got Arnold Schwarzenegger
We way overshot the mark. Yeah, there. And he was truly a dream to work with. Just every bit the professional you'd think he is. On time, knew his lines, 3 to 4 alts that he'd come up with ahead of time, game for everything. Incredibly influential in my development as a creator, but also as a human, you know.
He's played some of these characters himself. You know, you think about Commando or any of these guys that he played in the 80s.
Dutch and Predator, Terminator, Running Man. Yeah, no, it was incredibly surreal because this was always intended to be a smaller film. And I think as you hit the nail on the head, I love action adventure, big super spy hero, outside the laws, that sort of fantastical action-y world is always where I enjoyed creating even as a child. I was always drawn to that. Beverly Hills Cop, I think, is about as perfect a movie as you can get for my sensibilities.
And you once said that Eddie Murphy is your favorite SNL cast member.
Hands down. Like my first awareness of the show was through him.
And really, in real terms, the first real star to come out of the show.
Yeah.
I mean, the first big movie star, you think, arguably, who was the bigger movie star? Not the original cast, as talented as they were.
Sure.
Nobody was bigger than Eddie Murphy when he came out of it.
I mean, I don't know because I wasn't around for it at the time. I know, seemingly Chevy thought he was. I've heard enough people say that Belushi maybe was close.
But we'll never know.
We'll never know. We'll never know, certainly. But in terms of a star in an era of a cast of very talented people, I mean, he was just leagues and leagues and leagues above. And the run of 48 Hours to Beverly Hills Cop to hosting the show as an ensemble cast member.
After Nick Nolte didn't show up.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, right, exactly. I don't know of anyone who's done it better.
But as you're talking, you name those Eddie Murphy movies. Those are all movies where you play these characters who, if you looked under the surface, had to be incredibly lonely guys because they're all by themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And this idea of these loners who don't really connect to anything is kind of a taking off point for you in a lot of ways.
It is. It is. The isolation, the lone wolf is always much more interesting to me. And I was never connected to the hero, the king, I was always more drawn to the lieutenant, the guy who was there, would give his life, would fight, but at the end of the day, wander off in camp, set up camp by himself. And I'm sure that came out of my childhood, but I'm a weird blend of all things a little bit, as is this movie, which is my attempt at sort of making a cinematic stew of things that I love, which is the action, spy, assassination, shoot 'em up. and just comedy and just absurd characters and mockumentary, Spinal Tap, you know, all the Christopher Guest, Eugene Levy movies. I mean, between Monty Python, Mel Brooks, and those films, the Christopher Guest films, those are my church.
It's a big bite of the apple. We're talking psychology and archetype with my guest, Taron Killam. His first film as director and star and writer is Killing Gunther. But I guess one of the things I was thinking about, too, that happens in this movie a lot and is happening in these movies we've been talking about is characters get entrances. And everybody in this gets an entrance, don't mm-hmm. they?
Yes. Well, going back to Eddie Murphy, I think my favorite film character entrance of all time is hearing him screaming Roxanne in prison before you even
in 48 see him. Hours.
The best introduction. You know everything you need to know about him before you've even seen his face is my favorite. And yeah, I think a good entrance is important for anything, be it a film, a sketch, a novel.
It's funny you say that, though, because I think for me the difference between sketch comedy and a movie is that you can make an entrance in a sketch because often that's the way the character is defined for people.
Sure.
You see that person right away. But making an entrance in the movie, you've got to then make sure this character is worthy of being on screen.
Yes.
So you really create a big task for yourself in giving all these different characters
right.
an entrance. So I can see why yeah. it took you so long to write this.
Yeah. I mean, yes, certainly. And as you know, no one survives for long. You know what I mean? In this movie, spoiler alert. Which I as
or
always,
do they?
Or do they? Dun dun dun! No, people get killed pretty quickly. So it's important to capitalize on their screen time too, which I think was part of that. Of no one is safe. You know, these amateurs, these want to get rich quick millennials, if you will. You know. Bite off way more than they can chew. And a big theme about the film that was important to me and a reason I was, you know, reason 3,492 I was grateful to get Arnold is it's a theme of earned experience, right? Of earned lessons, of wisdom earned over time, of to become great. Can you become great overnight? And that certainly has not been my story. And I'm not being self-effacing. I just mean everything in my career, everything in my education, I just am a slow learner, has kind of been slow and steady, you know, little steps. And should I be fortunate enough to continue that way over a long life, I'll be ecstatic. But that's always interesting to me because we live in such an immediate society now, more and more.
And everybody wants to be a star right away. It's a lesson yes. we've learned from reality TV in the 21st
exactly.
century. You know, somebody like Lauren Conrad, mm-hmm. once you get out there, then basically you deserve a place on stage. And that's maybe the difference between that generation and the generation you're parodying here, which is there's a real sense of satire of basically millennial entitlement.
Yes.
It is.
Yes, very much so.
But still, we're getting back to, again, the difference. There's so much here to talk to you about, obviously.
Yeah.
But that difference between, again, the impression you make in a sketch mm-hmm. versus building something. I know you come from musical theater where it's yeah. really about sort of establishing, and what we're talking about actually happens in musical theater, making an entrance, but then that entrance doesn't define who and what the character is, isn't it?
Sure, right. Revealing themselves. Well, it's for a lot of the characters in Killing Gunther, it is an intentional de-evolution. It was important that, wow, that guy looks cool, that guy has a good weapon, or they're all living. It's an absurd idea that for a profession, I'm going to be a hitman, and especially the hitman of cinema, as we've come to have them defined for us through Les Samurai or Leon, or you know all these just suave, cool, slick, like you know. As I started writing, I was actually introduced to Man Bites Dog, and I was like, oh, that's hilarious.
Oh, that's what this is. This Man Bites
it really Dog. Is. You know, it's Disneyfied Man Bites Dog. You know, more colorful, a little more friendly. Certainly, same dark world, and. Hardcore Henry, and there are aspects of that we looked and tried to learn from because it was important to me an exciting experiment, especially as a first-time director, to see if we could hold focus on these absurd, idiotic characters who hopefully we care about or certainly can at least laugh at, and then put them in high-stakes, life-or-death situations where the action feels at least somewhat legitimate. And I think what I'm most proud of in the film are the 3 to 4 set pieces where I do think we achieved that.
Well, we've never had anybody here go from Hardcore Henry to Jean-Pierre Melville, but my guest, Taron Killen, did. His first film was by a director.
You also haven't had any, you've never introduced somebody by saying Moody's Point and 12 Years a Slave.
That's never happened, too. We'll take a break. Taron Killen's here. We're talking about his film. his first film's by a director. It's The Treatment. There's more to come. Stay with us.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back. We're calling all of popular culture with my guest, writer-director and film star, Taron Killen. His first film as writer-director is Killing Gunther. There's so much to talk about here, and including all the things you want to do, there's also music in this, and not only original songs and karaoke, but one of your characters, talking about people wanting to be something that they're not,
yes,
wants to be something very, and he sells it really beautifully. And
thanks.
Again, finally, this, and I connect this, I keep going back to legitimates, there's a mm-hmm. real kind of emotional truth to this in both these situations, that these people having something that's missing from their lives.
Yes. Yeah.
I mean, do you start with that? Is that the way to sort of, because you've got to make it play so it doesn't feel like you're watching a sketch comedy movie, but
yeah.
You talked about set pieces before, and there's one big set piece where cars are going off, mm-hmm. which, again, is really well staged.
Oh, thank you.
And you took on so much stuff as a first-time writer and director. I'm getting dizzy talking about this. But I do want to go back to that idea, for me, conceptually, of emotional truth mm-hmm. being so core to this thing.
Yeah, there's real sentimentality to this film. There are quiet moments, and those are my favorite kinds of things. And a great example, and obviously I don't think it's a hard connection to make, the BBC Office was brilliant at making you laugh absurdly at whatever, a work orientation harassment in the office place gone bad, being hijacked, and then this love story, this beautiful love story, and that balance of laughter into earnest emotion is something I wanted to attempt while still knowing what the film is, right? The film is intentionally absurd. But I think you don't stick around for 90 minutes if everything's a throwaway and everything's absurd and there's no real emotional pathos. And it is, in writing feature form, it is important for me to at least put thought into it and put attempt to create that for all characters in the film. And in terms of loneliness or longing, I think that was maybe just my relationship with dreaming, you know? Most of my childhood, from like age 7 to 16, I grew up in Big Bear, in a small mountain town. You know, always dreamed of being in the big city, of falling in love. I would fall in love with characters on TV and build relationships in my mind.
Who were some of those characters that you kind of...
Love Hewitt from Kids Incorporated, very important. A young Kerry Russell on the MMC, you know, and I mean... You can tell if you happen to find anyone who went to high school with me, they'll tell you that Natalie Portman was just like, I was going to marry her. I was going to meet her and marry her. And she was just the perfect woman. And
you basically grew up with her on screen.
Exactly right. Exactly. And a lot I think she's a year older than me. So it was perfect. It was perfect. And it all fell apart.
We'll pass word along. But I mean, you think back to The Professional, or Leon, as you so accurately called it. I mean, she's in a movie, so you get to fall in love with her in a movie that,
yes,
a kind of movie that you end up making eventually.
Exactly right. And I mean, and the next hurdle is to do something in Star Wars, because that was my other passion growing up always, was I was going to be a Jedi. And it was very important to me to get to audition to be Anakin, to be, you know, teen Anakin, to the point where my mom...
Did you
God
really try
her.
To go after this?
Elvis, I wish I had this tape to this day. I had friends. I went to LOXA, LA County High School for the Arts.
Sure.
So Tai Chi, who's like a budding filmmaker, took time out of his weekend to help me film an original action sequence.
You wrote a scene? You wrote an Anakin Skywalker scene?
I wrote a guy waiting on a beach, an exchange gone wrong. Like, do you have the microchip? And like, yeah, do you have the money? And there's a double cross and there's some martial arts on Santa Monica Beach. And then we run and then in an truly in a alleyway, I think behind 4th Street. There's like a dumpster fight where I find like a closet dowel, closet rod, very similar in length to a lightsaber. Oh, man. I wish I had this. And sweet Jessica Larson, who, you know, was an acting peer of mine, did a scene from Look Homeward, Angel in it with me,
no,
too.
No, yes. You're making this up.
I swear, I wish I had it. It just, I mean, I literally would never have to do any talking in any talk shows for the rest of my life. We could just show
don't eschew that. But on the other hand, I mean, what you just talked about basically here is that this kind of genre crash that that Killing Gunther is.
Yeah, yeah. Love, violence, death, laughter, the yin-yang of it all, I think, is very much my makeup.
It's the treatment. My guest who escaped being in any of the Star Wars films of the 90s is Taron Killam. His first film as director is Killing Gunther. But I guess as we're talking about this, too, I just sort of keep thinking about entrances. And one of my favorite things, and I even talked to Dan about this when he was here, was your entrance in your episode of Community.
Oh, awesome. Yes.
Which exists not only as a parody of Glee, but as its own thing. I mean, you have to believe all this stuff. And playing this so specifically in terms – but also size, because in so many things you've done as a sketch player, they're all about size. Mm. That's what I think of you as, and I think of you more as an actor than a comedian, because actors always think about size and which space they're going to take up in a frame or on the stage. And I've got to ask you when the idea of conceptually of size and filling space kind of came to you, because it's something that you do. And again, going back to that Community, and we may be able to find your audition tape for Star Wars, we can find that episode.
Yes.
And Dan was just sort of saying, he thought, wow, he really hit it the way I wanted to play it.
Oh, that's so nice.
It's got to be big but real at the same time.
Yeah, yeah. That show mastered that, you know, and my entrance is with Jim Rash, who is one of the all-time most brilliant, funny improvisers ever.
Who's also big and real at the same time.
Yeah, exactly. And where you would say size, I would say commitment. To me, it's the level of commitment to the tone of the show, right? And I was a huge fan of Community coming in and kind of like fought to do that episode, because I was like, you're kidding me. It's Community and they're singing and I please. And of just full commitment always. And I think that's where I've succeeded in comedy, is the willingness to, no matter how vulnerable or exposed you might feel, commit fully to the intention at hand. And in Community, for example, this is a man, you know, I understand I think, and maybe Dan would say otherwise, the goal to sort of lambast Glee and the absurdity of it as a performance style.
Yes, you know, a great line. Why is there always a regionals?
Yeah, what is regionals? what is regionals? But it was this the episode itself was musical, right? Which is very chest out, cheat, fourth wall, broad. And yeah, and I think, you know, I've been doing – as an actor, I've been attempting to make a career of this for a long time. And you learn to define, even just in the audition room, like, is it a single camera? Is it a multi-camera? Is it, you know, doing theater all through high school and a year at UCLA actually for musical theater before comedy kind of took over. You learn to set the dial, and a great piece of advice I was always given was like, go further than you think you need, because pulling back is much easier than adding on.
Yeah, even for TV where people who've come in here have talked about sometimes you want to be aware of not playing, going too big in the room, because you can sometimes scare people.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that I don't have the fear of that, because I've seen myself and have been felt successful in myself of being small and minimal and realistic and as broad as you can possibly be. And I think if you put yourself in the room and you do it once and you get the note, like, okay, bring it down. Like, great, I can do that. Even if out of nerves, it's quieter or less frenetic. That's easier to do than putting yourself out there of like, that was really great, but we really want you to go for it. And then you're, you know what I mean? That's where nerves shining through in something small is easier to hide than shining through trying to be big and broad and out there. But I think even in heightened performance, in being broad and doing sketch live, late night variety sketch, if it doesn't feel honest, if it doesn't feel somewhere based in reality, it won't make sense. It doesn't make sense, and you can't. It won't work.
It's interesting because you talk about growing up with SNL and that Eddie Murphy group, and we certainly had people come on before talk about the difference between coming up through like the UCB sort of groundling school is that it's less about trying to undermine somebody mm-hmm. and more about trying to be part of a troupe. Like Bill Hader's a friend who's done the show a few times, mm-hmm. and that idea of being big but also not basically upstaging somebody
yes.
yeah. is a hard needle to thread too, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. I think if there's any common thread I've found with people who prefer improv or sketch troupes versus comedy, stand-up or individual, you know, storytelling, whatever, is that need, either out of comfort or fear, which for me, I think it certainly was. The idea of being just Taryn and trying to make you laugh just based on my observations, thoughts, whatever, by myself on stage with no character, with no story to share, terrifies me. Like I just couldn't do it. I tried it a couple times and it just didn't feel right, where performing with somebody, the give and take, creating situations that reflect, you know, moments in our real lives, but maybe heightened to the 11th degree, is so much more satisfying to me. It just always has been. Just a beginning, a middle, and end. It feels more like play.
Okay. Tell me about the first play you saw. What was the first professional theater you saw? Do you remember?
I believe it was Cats here when the Amundsen was maybe it was at the Amundsen or maybe it was at the Schubert. Was that way in Century City?
Yeah, that's the Schubert's in Century City.
It might have been at the Schubert, actually. And it was so fun and wanted to be the rum-tum-tugger so bad. And both my parents are artistic and performers, so they very much encouraged that. They would do plays at Manhattan Beach Community Church, which we went to.
No kidding.
Yeah. And then when we moved to Big Bear, we sort of ingratiated ourselves to the community. And
was there a community theater in Big Bear that
you were
involved
with? Yeah, the Performing Arts Center in Big Bear is such a fantastic facility. It really is a beautiful, beautiful theater. And it's right as you come in up the front way, you know, up the 33. And so we would do stuff there, and then I would do stuff in school too.
What kind of stuff did you do at the Big Bear community? The community theater would just be much different than doing it at the school where,
very
you,
much
know,
so.
Where you know half the audience.
And the stuff at the PAC happened first. I remember I did Sister Mary Ignatius. I played.
No.
Yes, yes. And the big one was Amahl and the Night Visitors, the opera. I could hit those high notes then.
So what's your singing range, for God's sake?
Back then, better. Yeah, I don't know. And having done Hamilton, I felt a little bit like a sheep in wolf's clothing coming into the Broadway community, just because I love singing, I love musical theater. But in terms of honoring the technique and working out, I hadn't done it in a long time. And Liz Kaplan, who's a marvelous, marvelous vocal coach, really helped me out with that. And by the end of it, I felt like I belonged, and a lot of that is because of the cast and how kind and welcoming they were.
You've got to come back and do the show again, please.
Please, anytime. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, my pleasure. My guest is Taryn Killam. His first film is writer, director, and star is Killing Gunther, recording engineer here at KCRW, who also mixes the show's Cat York. It's edited by Blake Vite, who's associate producer. Tally ho, it's The Treatment. Catch up on past episodes of The Treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps, or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or if you listen to podcasts. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.